The talk tonight is about gratitude and contentment. Aspects of mudita and upekkha, or empathetic joy and equanimity. And remembering that the empathetic joy is that ability to connect to the joy in the world and appreciate it or feel gratitude toward it. And that the equanimity is that ability to connect to the vast range of joy and sorrow in the world. And hold it or abide with a deep acceptance of how things are. So going back to that phrase from the Buddha, that there are two very rare and precious human beings in this world. One who shows kindness, and then one who appreciates the kindness shown to them. So this gratitude is considered rare. And it means that we have received. And this is critical. It's like the gratitude isn't, in this case, it's not something, again, that's figured out through the thought process, but it means that there has been some part of us that actually has let go of control and that is able to receive and then is able actually to be thankful for that. Genuine, very, you know, the genuine kind. This is from The Book of Small by Emily Carr. The smell of the earth was rich. The pines and the cedars smelled spicy. The wind mixed all the smells into a great grand smell that made you love everything. I really love that. I love being somewhere where I don't have to explain who Emily Carr is. That's the best relief of them all. That feeling, you know, that when we really love everything and it's so genuine, yeah, this is how empathetic joy feels. And this connection to the earth, you know, being here at Hollyhock, if we don't have it, that connection, certainly it's a doorway into connecting with the earth's body, and that the earth's body includes the eagles or the yellow skunk cabbage. You know, our bodies. It's like being able to see that when we touch the earth with the bottom of our foot, that the earth can be our benefactor. I mean, not something randomly intellectual or casual, but really that very deep sense of being born from and being part of and belonging. There's a Pali word, Anjali, and there are several different descriptions of it, but it's like when people bow, when they put their hands together in front of their heart center and bow, that is meant to be a gesture of reverence. And we have that reverence for the deep part of ourselves that is so good. That the goodness, the goodwill, all these things that we're talking about, really. So we're not bowing to a personality. And you know, this is so important when we walk in the hall and you see us bowing to the Buddha. We're not bowing to a personality. And it's very helpful to remember that there was no image, there was no human image for the Buddha for like 400 or 500 years. That's amazing. So there, it really would be like a footstep or an empty seat. You know, very, and this, the image was actually likened to the Greek god Apollo. So the traditional way of Anjali, you know, when you go in a traditional Buddhist monastery or bow to a monk or any of that, it's like you're bowing to the Buddha. But the meaning of it is what's so important, or you're bowing to the Dhamma. But again, it's the meaning, bowing to the Sangha. The meaning for us is what matters. And that touching our forehead to the ground, to the earth, is meant to be, instead of the hands touching at the heart center, that touching our forehead to the earth is like a deeper gesture of reverence. So, of course, it's very important for us that didn't grow up with any of this stuff, first of all, not to feel like we have to bow in that way. It's not a requirement. And then getting that sense that I remember when I first was exposed to it, it was easy for me. I like bowing. I just love putting my forehead on the earth. And I would bow to the flowers on the altar, because that's had meaning for me as a child, and I could make that connection. So over time, my understanding of what I have been bowing to has changed, and hopefully it keeps changing. There was some years that I really felt like every time I bow a lot, if you can imagine, a lot of bowing, and just that sense that I feel like I've bowed in every mental state possible, just through every kind of calm, boredom, storm, just possible, and just feeling that quality of just being with things as they are. That peace, the contentment that comes through not taking it personally, and understanding that it's when we accept things as they are, it doesn't mean that we're condoning it. It means that it's the truth of what is happening. It's the fact. And that these teachings, particularly upekkha or equanimity, bring up a lot for us, because we often will feel like if I accept this, this means that we're saying that it's right. And that's not what it means. It means that it is happening. So say we unconditionally accept something that really isn't acceptable, like people hungry on the planet. That is so unacceptable. And yet it does happen, and that's what's being said, that it is happening, and then how can we relate to that? Can we respond to that with care, compassion, equanimity, rather than rage? So these are, we'll touch into these again and again, these aspects. The deepest aspect of Anjali that I found once in a Pali dictionary, the last definition, was that the bowing was making a full offering of ourselves. It's like a whole offering of our body and mind. You know, it's a very beautiful thing when you see that a bow is an offering, or actually maybe we can start to grasp that our life is so precious. Human birth is considered so rare and exceptional in this tradition, that there can be that way, that our life is an offering. And how beautiful that is, that when we start to see that that's a possibility. And it's so easy, as we all know, to take things that are so fundamental for granted. So shelter. Just shelter, just warmth, just the heat that we have here, and the clothing, and the food, you know, just that way in which we forget. So that sense of, like, even the sense of our karma, the goodness of the karma, that or the karma that we just, again, we so easily can slide into discontent, mainly because we're just not remembering. It's that basic, again, those two rare and rare and precious kinds of human beings. You know the beings that often touch us are often the most grateful. They're not taking things for granted. For example, our breath happens, luckily, fortunately, it's still happening for each one of us here. And if you've ever been at someone's death, it's like so powerful, those the last few minutes of someone's life where you're just with their breath, and it's so clear that at that moment when the breath stops, how big a shift it is. So that sense of making that connection with our breath as a force of its air element, and it's like so fundamental to life. This is part of what we do here. Our steps, our breath. The last of the four guardian meditations is reflecting on our death or our mortality, and it's considered a protection, a great protection, not taking life for granted and knowing it can happen any time. So it's not meant to be a morose or morbid reflection. It's actually meant to give us like that the sense again of not taking life for granted and making good use of our time here. Like, we would consider this being here at this retreat really good use of your time, you know. I saw a lot of film clips live on television when I grew up of Martin Luther King, but I really never ran into his transcripts and down where Steve and Kate are staying. I found this book on the great sermons of Martin Luther King Jr. So I just wanted to read this from that perspective of the combination of death being a great protection, the reflection on it, but also the way that he transformed that into gratitude. So he made this speech 2 months before he died, and it's well known that there was almost like this premonition he was having. He said, "Every now and again I think about my own death, and I think about my own funeral. And I don't think of it in a morbid sense. But every once in a while I just ask myself, what is it that I would want said? And I leave the word to you this morning." So there's a bit more, I guess it's so cool. He said, "If any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long." "And every now and then I wonder what I want them to say. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That is not important. Tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd just like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love someone. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. And I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those who were naked. I want you to say that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. And I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. And what I'm saying is that that comes out of great reverence for life and great gratitude for life, rare and precious. And there's such a different way that that can be expressed in the human world. There's such a range of someone like Martin Luther King. And then there are beings that we just don't see, or, you know, they're just so, they are known as fully enlightened, but they're so quiet, we don't even get to see them. One day, not last year, I didn't go to Burma this year, but the year before, when I was in Burma, the abbot of the monastery, Sayadaw Ulakana, was quite ill, but he was still teaching a lot, but he was ill. And he couldn't go up the steps anymore, so we used to come down to his, basically his, you know, bedroom place you could visit him for the Dhamma talks. And his teacher, one of his teachers, showed up in the middle of the Dhamma talk. There was no communication. He just somehow knew he was sick and came to give him energy. And it was so beautiful because it was such a surprise, and it was in the middle of the talk, and it was the last Dhamma talk. And Sayadaw Ulakana was just like a little boy. Like he just looked like a little kid that had just been given the greatest gift in the world. And you see him bow down to his teacher and make a special place for him. It was really moving. And this teacher is known as fully enlightened. So, you know, that means really that sense that the Buddha said when he became fully enlightened, done is what had to be done. You know, when we get to say that, that is someday, done is what had to be done. It's so deep. So he just sat there, and if you didn't tune into his vibe, it was a real loss, because the vibe was so peaceful and so quiet. And then the thing that was so funny is that was when we had to break silence, and people had been quiet for a month and silence for a month, and then they went up for tea, and it was just like so loud. For a month it's so silent, and then you can hear people. And you know, when you start, you can't stop usually. It's so painful, you know, and it was like the sound from a distance was so painful, but it's a necessity, you know. And then suddenly Sayadaw got word to me that we were going to be allowed to go see this teacher for a little while. He's old too, but, you know, so I had to go up to the group and say, you know, time to be quiet. But they just talked for 10 minutes, you know, and they were leaving the next day. So it was pretty intense. So they followed me up to this room, but had started talking again. They couldn't stop, you know. So we were in this very small room in a different area, like really small, cramped in, and people were just talking and talking, and I had to take care of something else. So finally I came in and I sat down and I was like kind of thinking that this teacher was just going to come. And then I realized he's not going to come in here like this. He was in there waiting. He had been there like it had been 15 minutes. And then I was like, oh, I just got it. And I said, okay, everybody. And I just was shh. And everyone just was quiet. The second it got quiet, he walked in. You know, these guys aren't, they don't chat. You know, it's really not what they do. And it's like, we don't even realize what that could be like. But when you get in a silent retreat and you get a sense of like the power of not speaking and then imagining that none of the speech that's coming out is motivated by aversion or attachment or delusion, there's actually not that much to say. It is funny. Yeah, it's either funny or cryable. You know, it's like there's just, you know, there's a lot of quiet, a lot of consideration before our speech. And I remember at that point in time, when I go to Burma, I never feel like I bring enough for people. There's so little that people have, and I usually have a suitcase full of stuff. And I was horrified that I didn't have a gift for him. So that's what I remember, that I had run up to my kuti way up these steps while people were going in, and I looked around and all I had was a bag of cough drops. So I felt so like it wasn't going to be enough, but it was all I had. So I went running up, brought it down, and I was sitting there feeling like, oh, this isn't enough. That was just the whole thing. This isn't enough. But I knew I had to offer something, so I offered these cough drops. And he gave a very long talk about generosity and how important it is, and particularly medicine for monks. And just like, he just made me feel like I had given him the best thing you could possibly give. Really, it was just, again, there's that sense of the beauty of tuning in and receiving with such total elegance. It was really moving. And then my favorite part of what he talked about after that was, you know, we think of a arahant, a fully enlightened being, as, you know, really evolved, right? I mean, it's amazing. And he started describing these realms of existence, and he started like sort of at the bottom where he was. So he started talking about a mere ordinary arahant. And then went from there, you know, to the more evolved arahants. And it was so great. I was sitting there like, It's just that up-leveling, you know, it's an up-leveling, and it gives you such a sense of elegance and beauty of what's possible. In those stories that are from the Haida Gwaii tradition that I love so much, they describe human beings in their mythology as ordinary surface birds. And I don't know if you ever look at the ducks on the ocean, you know, while you're here, but when you look at, just try it sometime, just contemplate them for a while and think about that that's the description of human beings, you know. And it's again, to think of ourselves that way, it can be more humorous and easier to understand why things are so messed up in a way in the world. It's like when you really realize 10 days of sitting, when you realize, actually, honestly, how much we actually are motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion, and you look at the world, it's much more comprehensible. Yeah, it's not a surprise. And that can be very helpful, I think, to just to see. How many arahants do you know? How many have I met? I can count them on this hand. And all of them I have ever met have had like 100% total transformative effect on me. When you listen to Martin Luther King and you hear it, it makes us tear up or be moved because, yeah, it's like there's something so genuine there and so important for us. Because then it's like we sense that we're a part of that. We know we have that possibility. So the deep quiet that I'm talking about in this particular being, Sayadaw's teacher, it's not just that there's like the absence of talking, it's an absence of reactivity. You know, there is just a deep quiet, but it's the quiet of that deep contentment with things just as they are. So we can sometimes talk about the near enemy of equanimity, this unconditional peace or unconditional acceptance. So we'll name these things like indifference. Indifference can look so much like equanimity. That's the meaning, remember, of the near enemy. The near enemy is the experience that seems so much like it, but isn't. So it's that masquerade, the experience masquerades, but you know because there's an absence of feeling connected. There's a feeling of being shut down rather than connected. And there's many aspects of this, like naivete. That's a great one, yeah? And sometimes naivete can feel so good because we just, it's like kind of having your head in the sand, you know? We don't want people to be motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion. We don't want to know about it. And so we pretend that it's not operating. And it's a great protection. It's the best we can do often. So in that category is passivity or denial. And then, of course, the opposite of this equanimity is when there is pleasure or joy, it's holding on to it. The reaction is the holding on to it when it starts to pass. That's what we mean by reacting. And this is what the Buddha taught was suffering. And that when the pain appears, physical, mental, emotional, it's that fear or the pushing it away, the irritation, annoyance, aversion, aggression, violence. You know, it's like these two polarities of reacting. One thing that's really important to remember is that equanimity, no matter, like anyone in this room, it's equally rare for all of us, no matter what type we are. It's like if you saw an apple blossom in the orchard now, and that the time it takes for the apple to grow and ripen. Equanimity is like this. You can rush some other spiritual qualities, but you cannot rush equanimity except by coming into a longer retreat. It's that coming into the longer retreat and going through the sleepiness, then equanimity happens. It's like when equanimity happens, it's like a kind of grace, and you really believe it should be impermanent and should be permanent. And then when we find out that equanimity is impermanent, oh, it's so bittersweet. So we go through the ups and downs every day, every day, every day. That is what incubates this equanimity, which is being okay just with things as they are, and not critical, not taking them personally. That's how equanimity can happen, because it'll feel like a kind of grace, but it'll happen after you have really put in some time. So fake equanimity, which we're all brilliant at, you know, we could all just sit there with our Oscar, actually, you know. It's amazing how good we are at it. And, you know, how it looks is often it's, you can see it the clearest when you have had some equanimity. And then you're sitting there, and then there's some place in your body that has a lot of intense sensation, pain, right? And it's come back. And we'll sit there and go, well, I don't really care if it's come back. That's the first sign. Or, you know, there's some loud noise or something, and we're like, because it hasn't bothered us, right? It's we've been fine with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We've been totally fine. And then something happens, and we're not okay with it. But we pretend we're okay with it because we don't want to face the fact that it's gone. And it isn't ours, and it isn't personal. So that's, again, the beauty of the time and space to start seeing ourselves. The sweetest experience that can happen is equanimity. We want it so much. We know that's the mind of an arahant. We know that's the six-limbed equanimity. And when it starts to go, it's like it's usually what we yearn for the most once we've tasted it. And it's learning to let the wanting it back be okay. It's totally okay to want it back. In fact, of course we want that back. Why wouldn't we want it back? But we can't control it. It'll come and go by itself. So noticing all those attempts to pretend we're okay when we're not, just it takes a lot of energy. And just being able to go, oh, it's the wanting it to be okay place, but it isn't. You just learn to not take it personally and not react and accept that it's changed. That takes practice. So this, sometimes it's like when we get a glimpse of this, we get a sense that the awareness, when we talk about liberation or freedom, the liberated mind, we get a sense that the awareness just is not imprisoned by the experience. So if there is some intense physical pain, it's there, the equanimity isn't getting rid of it, but there's just the awareness is not sucked in, and it's not feeling like we have to get rid of it and it's mine. It's just okay, it's just sensations. It's just phenomena coming and going by itself. You know, and again, it's like we can't make that happen. It's not a command. It's not like you can have this part of you that's a drill sergeant going, let go! You know, it's not like that. It's the understanding that allows that to be like that. And we can recover mindfulness at any moment. And this is the very important, the practice of, it's like, it sounds like I'm saying to be okay with not being okay. But it really is possible when the equanimity goes, there is a way, like say indifference happens, say the heart just starts to close and we feel disconnected. It is possible in those moments to go, oh, disconnection, feeling disconnected. Great. Let me see what this feels like. You see, we've recovered. And that is possible at every moment. With concentration, there's always the fear of losing it. But with mindfulness, you can recover it at any moment. Any moment there's that remembering that we can be with anything. And this takes time. It's like mindfulness, equanimity. You keep learning that the experience does not matter. Whatever we're experiencing isn't the point. The point is, how is the awareness relating to it? And you know, we learn it, we forget. We learn it, we forget. We learn it, we forget. And it's just that, just keep putting in your time. And it's just, it's so amazing when we can say, oh, great, indifference. And you hear me exaggerate it, but it really has to sometimes be exaggerated. It really has to be, oh boy, I was really hoping that I could take a better look at indifference right now. Because it's usually not like that. We're usually, oh no, my heart's closing. And we take it so personally and we think something's wrong. There is nothing wrong with that experience. It's simply indifference. Of course it happens. And learning how to be okay with it. Usually the attention needs to open up. And as Steve has been saying, there's different flavors to the Brahmaviharas. It's like compassion, or it's like a way that we can connect to the indifference. And then by caring about it a bit, maybe then more acceptance will come. Or maybe, you know, in that process, some loving kindness will be helpful. It's not like they're that different, but they are like having some orange sherbet rather than vanilla. They're just different, a little bit different skill. So the other day when I mentioned that my first retreat, I got a sense that about 99% of my experience wasn't acceptable to me. That's really changed. It's not 100%. And I felt like one of the expressions that helped me understand how to make that shift was the expression, just enough. And the translation was from something that I read, that the Japanese word for begging bowl is translated as just enough. Begging bowl, you know, again, meaning. So the monks and nuns in the Buddhist tradition, they don't go buy food. They have a begging bowl. This is just to keep in mind what the Buddha encouraged. It's like they have a begging bowl, and they only eat what someone puts in their bowl, and not afternoon. And sometimes they get really good stuff, and sometimes they get not such good stuff, and depending on where you are and who you are. But it's like they don't get to say, you know, I want almonds instead of peanuts. You know, no, really, I really mean it. It's like if you even took it as a metaphor, the begging bowl, the translation meaning just enough, that as lay people we can really learn from that, we can translate that into, was this day for you just enough? But that's usually much too large. It's like, was this breath that we just took just enough? Was this Dhamma talk just enough? Well, it's long. There's probably parts of it that you can take as just enough. And this doesn't mean that we have to feel guilty and shame whenever we're wanting more. What we do is we recover the mindfulness and we feel like it's not enough, and we shift into letting ourselves want more. That's the gift of mindfulness. That's then the wanting more, in that case, is just enough. In fact, any experience is more than enough for us to really try to be with, right? If you try to be with the whole breath from the beginning and middle and end, you'll find that it's a lot to pay attention to. And if you try to pay attention to the sound of a bird just for a little while, very easy to go off. But it's just enough if we make the connection and stay with it. It's the same for being with anger, or being with shame, or being with joy. It's like when that awareness can just totally accept that that is what's happening. No past, no future, you know, not trying to conjure up something that we would like better, but just that, I can guarantee you it's always just enough. And it's when we fall prey to our preferences, it's like when we believe that the preference is so, so clearly more important than the truth. And you could call that being a fool. We get fooled. We get fooled by the object of the wanting. And everyone in here can just totally testify to how much we do it. We get fooled by the object of the aversion. We get caught in the whole play of something happening out there. And it's so hard to pull it back into here. The Buddha called that the suffering that ends suffering. That willingness to really feel indifference and to really feel wanting more and to really feel not wanting something. You know, that ability to not project it, not drown in it, but just to let it come and go by itself. And then liberation is coming when you can do that. Not have to act on it. There was a experience I had once picking Steve up at the airport in Honolulu that helped me really see what it's like to see a preference very clearly and know I wasn't going to get it. It was so powerful. He was supposed to come in from somewhere probably at like 6 at night, and the plane was delayed, and I think it came in at like 2 or 3 in the morning. So I knew it was going to be late, but I didn't anticipate this amazing flash flood that happened as I was driving to the airport. And then not only was there a flash flood, but as I was going up the highway, there was this neon flashing sign that, you know, I didn't know, that like rerouted traffic through a place in Hawaii, that Honolulu, I didn't know it, rerouted it through this part of town that was not lit up and dark. And so, to make a long story short, I love describing this because it was so interesting. So I'm going down the highway, flash flood, I see this sign that says you can't go up the ramp to the airport. And I was like, that doesn't mean me. Right? You know, I do that, really. I'm so good at it. It's like, you know, because there were a couple of times it came up before you actually couldn't do it, right? And they had it gated. You couldn't. But I just, like...
Don't you have a tape on Michael?
No. Anyway... So yeah, you finally have to come to grips with reality. So I kept thinking, they surely don't mean me. I'm going to get to go up this thing. But it, you know, finally I get to the exit and I can't take it. And it's like, oh. So then I go up and you take the next exit and it's really raining, just like big puddles. And I get to a stop sign. I take a left. No signs, of course, what to do. I almost tried to call somebody, but I didn't. And I'm going down this hill. I've never been in, like, I've never driven in this bad a flash flood. And I'm coming down a hill, and I see a big intersection ahead, and I go to step in the brakes, and I, what do they call it, hydroplaning? Mm-hmm. And I just, like, I've driven in snow, I know how to steer into the skid and all that, and it was just like, there was no control. Like, it was like, just amazing. And I really saw that I had a preference. It was so clear. You know, it's like I had a preference for this not to be happening. I had a preference for no cars to go through the intersection, right? It was all just like so slow and so clear. And I knew I couldn't act on it. And it was so liberating. There was such a feeling of like having to surrender so clearly. And it was like not, you know, it was not a pleasant that the experience of like anticipation of what could happen was not pleasant, but the actual like surrender was very peaceful, really like this deep contentment, like, okay, what can you do, right? But that's how it is most of the time for us. In actual fact, life is moving that fast and we actually don't have that much control. We can see that we'll have preferences and we can act on them, but we don't have that much control about the result of our action, really. And it was, you know, it's like I went swirling through this thing. You know, it's amazing. I mean, phew, it was so lucky that I was okay. I kind of bumped into this curb and sign. But for hours, that sense of like how clear the difference is between a preference and acting on it and surrendering to, we don't have that much control. We actually don't. I have a neighbor. I've rented in this neighborhood before, so when I've been there, I travel a lot, but he's quite old, and he's a trumpet player. And recently I read in some magazine that he's quite a famous trumpet player. I didn't know it. But every morning he plays the scales, but not at the same time. So it can be 7 o'clock, it could be 8 o'clock, it could be 9 o'clock, but it's hauntingly beautiful. I mean, it's hard to believe that scales could be so beautiful. And when you're on retreat, I know you get kind of, you can hear anything, and it's pretty exciting. Yeah. But really, it's so beautiful. And as he's gotten older, he rests about 5 or 10 minutes between when he goes really high. Like before, he would just keep going up and up and up and up and up, and it's beautiful, and it always reminds me how important practice is. He's great. He's very well known, and every day he's like 90 something. He still does his scales, and beautifully, not casually. Very, very dedicated. Really beautiful. And this particular day that I noticed that he's starting to rest before he tries to hit the real high notes, there was another neighbor trying to start their lawnmower. And you know the rope ones that you have to pull, not the sit-down ones with the key. And he was just pulling and pulling and pulling. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, that's how metta practice is sometimes. You know, it's just like, you just feel like you're just doing. And here they were, both together, just like this man who just does his scales, and the lawnmower that you just pull and crank and crank until it gets going, and it's so much, the practice. And it's okay. It's like, it's okay. It's like making that full anjali to that this is how the human world is. That, yeah, we don't give out t-shirts at the end of the retreat that says, I don't have to do this anymore. It might sell well. But it's like, that's why it's called practice. You know, and it's deep. It's deep in us to want to get the degree or go for postgraduate work, but and then feel like we don't do it anymore. And the things in life that we really start to see, if we really love the truth, if we love it, then we will keep at it because it's the truth. So I'd like to end with another Emily Carr from the Book of Small again. There was much to see as we went up the river, and we went slowly because there were so many things to get over and under. Sometimes there were little rims of muddy beach, pocked with a dent of deer hooves. Except for the stream, the place was very quiet. It was like the stillness of a bird held in the hand with just its heart throbbing. It was like the stillness of a bird held in the hand with just its heart throbbing. Gratitude, just enough, and deep contentment. It's like the, it's worth all the ups and downs to come to that kind of quiet and peace. Let's sit for a minute. May we keep facing the suffering that ends suffering until done is what had to be done.